actually asked for this opportunity because I felt it was only fair that the Women's Zen College get some part of the series of talks in the 25th Yahrzeit of the Rav, since obviously the Black students of Yeshiva have had no opportunity to be exposed to the Rav directly, though there are a number of faculty members at CERN who are Talmidim of the Rav. You have the privilege of having the opportunity of studying Jewish philosophy with Rabbi Dr. David Chatz, who's one of the primary experts on the philosophical board of the Rav. You take Gemara with Rabbi Kahn, you'll understand what he's trying to accomplish after I give you some sense of the Shir of the Rav. And Dr. Carnifogel just showed me an article he had written that's going to come out soon about how the Rav utilized his knowledge of Jewish history in his explanation of the Pinos on Tisha B'Av, even though he never used Jewish history in his Marashim. The topic that I chose is the Rav as an educator, but that would not be the word that the Rav himself had used. The Rav describes himself many, many times as a Melamed. Well, a teacher would say, Melamed. Kadosh Baruch Hu describes himself as Melamed Torah Lama Yisrael. It's good enough for God to be a Melamed, so it's good enough for me to be a Melamed. I brought with me one of the number of books that have appeared on different people's hesbedim or memories of the Rav, because I thought this one was particularly helpful because it included comments from many, many students of the Rav over different decades, called Mentor of Generations, Reflections, Rabbi Joseph E. Soloveitchik, edited by Zev Elif. Initially, much of it were articles that appeared in the Commentator, and there are a whole list of people who wrote. One of the things that you may find particularly interesting because it's so different is a conservative rabbi wrote an article in the early 1970s about attending the Rav's shiurim at the Maria Shul in the west side of Manhattan, and what an extraordinary experience it was. And the Rav thanked him and wrote a nice note to him in return, and that appears in the book as well. The Rav, aside from being, world-class Talmud Chacham and Jewish philosopher, was also an extraordinary teacher and educator. The Rav mastered many, many disciplines. That was true intellectually, that he was knowledgeable in endless different areas, but even in terms of different ways of communicating Torah. So, for example, he gave, on the night of Gimel Shvat, his father's Yahrzeit, a major discourse in Lamport Auditorium that was filled, literally filled, including the balcony, and he gave it in Yiddish. This was in the early years, all the shiurim were in Yiddish, and it consisted of at least 2 hours of halacha, followed by more than 2 hours of agadata. Remarkably, the agadata came out of the halacha, they had said. And this was a finished product. The Rav would raise 7 different questions based on different Gemaras or Rambams, all of whom, each one seemed unconnected to the others, and then came up with one insight in which he just explained everything with the singular insight. And while he took comments from the floor, it was basically a frontal lecture. It was an incredible performance of brilliance and just overwhelmed people. And it was meant to overwhelm people in memory of his father. The shiur he gave in yeshiva was totally different. In fact, there were occasions where the insight that he said in the Eretz shiur would come up in the daily shiur and get mentioned in 30 seconds and he moved on, because it was not the point of the regular shiur. I'm going to focus mainly on the regular shiur. I'll speak a little bit about the rabbi that educated Maimonides. I had the opportunity to work for him in Maimonides and to teach there and be an assistant principal. But I want to start with the shiur. Now, over the years, the shiur changed somewhat, but essentially only changed as the rabbi got older. He got milder and more grandfatherly like than he was in the early years. The goal of the shiur was not simply for the rav to tell his students the Torah that he had. One can now get, Rabbi Reichman has put out a number of volumes of Rishimos of the shiurim of the rav on different mesechtes. Rabbi Schechter has put out his notes of the rav and a number of mesechtes in terms of the shiurim he gave relating to Shabbos and Yom Tovim. Rabbi Shurkin put out three volumes of Harei Kedem. All of them will tell you, each one as in the terminology and as he understood the rav, what the Torah was. But you will get no sense of the shiur from any of them. The shiur was an opportunity for the students to join in with the Rav to figure out what the real deep meaning conceptually of the sugya that we're learning, how to understand the thinking of the different Rishonim. We were expected to prepare very heavily, very seriously, and we started the shiur with the Rav calling on someone to read the Gemara. And even though the Rav had learned many of these mesechtos numerous times and had extraordinary memories, there was no question he remembered everything that he had said before, he always approached the Gemara and the Rambam anew. Learning means to look at something new. Learning is not reviewing. In fact, the Rav commented once, and I would ask the question, I assumed that would be the answer, about what's now popular in yeshivas, the Bekir's Seder. I'm just covering ground quickly to broaden one's knowledge, to know a lot of things, a lot of Gemaras, and the Rav was opposed to it. Because to the Rav, the notion that one studied something without trying to delve into understanding it fully made no sense. But true in Torah Shebiksav, where the words have Kedusha, that reading the Torah has meaning. But in Torah Shebiksav, the words are not the Kedusha. It's the idea. It's a concept. So if you're going to just do it superficially, then you're not learning. He would call on boys to read. He would ask them to explain. Explain did not mean repeating the words. Explain means what concept was being discussed. To get to the crux of the matter. The Rav's genius in many ways was that he understood what was fundamental and what was secondary in the text, right? And he never got caught up in a side question. He would say, that doesn't bother me. Not that it didn't bother him. It means we're going to go off on a tangent. We won't understand the text any better. We have to be focused. And he expected us to be as serious as he was. He didn't expect us to be as smart or as knowledgeable, but as serious. And I have a little story. When I finished my second year in Yeshiva College, Yeshiva had started the Smicha plan, and in the third, which was 3 years after college, in the third year of the Smicha plan, the Rav was teaching Yoredeya. And someone in the office suddenly got concerned if we allow college students to go to the Yoredeya Shia, then they're going to want to get Smicha early because they've already learned Yoredeya. So we have to throw them all out for the Shia. We're going to only have Smicha students in the Shia. When this got back to the Rav realizing that often the case when younger people are put into a higher level class, it means that they're capable, came up with a solution. He was going to say a separate shiur on Masechta, that he always said, for next 2 years with Sanhedrin, for college students only. Right. Now we had a shiur, first day of the Sanhedrin shiur, and there were only a handful of us who had been in the shiur before. I had actually been in the shiur for only a few months after Pesach the year before. Right? The Rav opened at the first point we did. Mari comes to the Rashi. He asks him to explain a Rashi. And the boy repeats the Rashi. The Rav says, no, I want you to explain it. Meaning, what was the concept? What was Rashi trying to teach us? Why did Rashi say it? Right? And it's Rashi explaining what is called gzeila, stealing. What type of act falls into that category and what doesn't? What were the criteria? And the boy didn't understand what the Rav wanted. He'd never been in Shia before. He didn't put an answer. Well, we asked another boy. It started going down the road. And after a few boys, it got worse and worse because people started guessing. Right? And the Rav realized it was an opportunity to teach us something. So he went down the row, went up to the second row. Suddenly he came to a boy who had been Yeshia before. He realized that boy would know what he was driving at and skipped him. He skipped every single boy who had been Yeshia before. And then he gave the Shia Musar of, you have to prepare properly. If you want to be in my Shia, you have to prepare properly and seriously. And that means you have to put your effort into analyzing the text. Seemed harsh. Some people were thrown by it. But everybody came back. And they understood that you had to be serious about preparing. What were the Rav's goals? I can't tell you for sure because he didn't announce goals. What I think were his goals is he wanted to train us to become serious Talmidei Chachamim. And if any way he could do that was to involve us in the creative process. Whereas he didn't say, this is the Teretz, he tried to figure it out with us in the Shia. He encouraged us to think on our own. He encouraged us to ask questions on what he said. And if someone asked him a really good question, he would stop, reject the idea that he had been saying up until then, unless he could answer the question properly, and start rethinking the subject. Now, probably he knew where he was going all along. Part of it was maybe a little bit of performance, but it was a real process of analysis that we participated in. And there were no shortcuts. You worked on it. And one of the things that was always striking was how intensely devoted the Rav was to coming up with a correct analysis. And if it meant that the shiur that should have taken 2 hours took 4 hours, it took 4 hours, till he was satisfied. And he might come back the next day and change it. And he was so serious about things, he couldn't understand why we were just watching him perform. Right? We should have been bothered if we didn't know Pshat and the Rashi. We couldn't explain the machlokas between the Rambam and the Raivis. It should trouble us. We shouldn't go back and wait for the Rav to solve it for us. Our concern for Torah should be that strong, and our commitment to truth should be that strong. And that, sooner or later, we all understood that. That was what was expected of us. To do the best that we can. The Rav did not tolerate people not preparing, nor would he accept, until he got much older, sloppy thinking. When he got older, the Rav softened a lot, and boys would say something that was, some of us thought was ridiculous, and the Rav would say, "You meant to say such and such," to which the boy, of course, readily agreed, even if he never meant it at all, and that's it, it was okay. So the purpose of his educating us was to create a new generation that would be able to transmit not just his Torah, but the learning process to the next generation. And if I step back a little bit, when the Rav came to America, 1933, the American community was moving away from observance. The strongest movement was the conservative movement. Orthodoxy was not doing well. And even the people who were committed to observance, if they were not older and educated than the yeshivas in Europe, they were doing so without a solid foundation of knowledge. They were traditional. They were keeping customs, right? Traditions, but they were couldn't explain why. Right? On Shabbos, we make kiddush, we eat gefilte fish, chicken soup, right? And we don't do work, whatever falls under that category. And the Rav was very concerned that this was not, there was no solid foundation. And therefore, the Rav was concerned that people understand that everything is based on halacha, on its internal logic to it. It's very profound, and it's solid, and can be maintained. So he worked on this in two different dimensions. One is in yeshiva. When I came to yeshiva, every single Rebbe on the college level was European, all trained in European yeshivas, great Talmidei Chachamim, but they came from a world that was no more. And it was going to be a time that would have to be a next generation. And where would that next generation come from? Because there were no more yeshivas in Europe. Israel was first getting some yeshivas. Yeshiva's going to have to reproduce itself. And it's the Rav's demanding training that made it possible for yeshiva to reproduce itself. At the same time, the Rav never wanted to make copies. The Rav wanted people to think on their own. And even if they didn't come to the same conclusions he came from, so that's also okay. As long as you're serious, you're devoted to learning, you have a mastery of the text, you had to read the text properly. Famously, I mean, around the years that I was in the early years that I was in the Shir, is when the Meiris came out. At all familiar with the Meiri, he's a great Rishon from Provence. The Meiri writes in a very clear and simple Hebrew, and he quotes earlier Rishonim, which means that instead of having to work through the early Rishonim and figure out what they were saying, you looked in the Me'iri and he told you in a handful of nice Hebrew words. And the Rav didn't want anybody to use the Me'iri. You have to learn how to read the Rishonim inside. You try to figure out what you think that Rishonim is saying by knowing how to learn it inside. Even the famous brisket terminology, there were times when the Rav, someone mentioned in the book, I remember a different time when the Rav was concerned that people would start answering questions by throwing out all the brisket terms. I won't go into what those terms are now, you know, and answer any question. This is this and that category. And the Rav said, stop throwing out terminology. Terminology is only valuable if it helps explain the concepts you understand. But if you're just throwing around terms, it doesn't mean anything. In fact, in Shia, at one point he stopped using the terms for a while to let people know that's not cover for thinking. The same way that the Rav was concerned in the Shia that the boys learn how to learn, he was concerned for the broader community as well. So the Rav did many forms of education for the broader community. There was the shiur for Balabatim on Tuesday nights in the Meraya Shul, in which at the same time major Talmid Chachamim would come, and it was open to everyone. There were women who came. Someone wondered how women in the 1970s, not only know Gemara, but know Yiddish as well. That's what they came, right? And it was open to people participate. He assumed that people prepared for the shiur for lay people. It was not the same demands of the shiur in yeshiva, but the level of learning was very high, because the Rav was no such thing as superficial learning. Now I'm going to move a little bit to the Rav in Maimonides. I had the honor of being there, the teaching. The first thing that struck me, I was just there a few days, there were worksheets for the teachers to teach the halachas of the Yom Tov. Right? And they were by level, from kindergarten through 12th grade. It wasn't just teach this, by level. And at Rosh Hashanah, kindergarten, right? Teach the children that there's a mitzvah to hear the sound of the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, and there's a minhag, there's a custom to dip apple in honey. I don't think that the four-year-olds knew the difference between a mitzvah and a minhag, but the Rav wanted from the very outset that the children should not be taught. We do a bunch of things, right? We give apple and honey, we listen to the shofar. No, some things are mitzvahs, some are from the Torah, some are midrabanan, some are minhagim, and they're different. And we shouldn't ever lose sight of that, of those differences. Right? We should never lose sight of the differences. The importance of people understanding halacha properly is the real explanation for something that has been explained in other ways. In Maimonides, the Gemara that was taught was always connected to halacha. The students start off with brachos, learning about Kriya Shema and Tzviva. They then learned about Psachim, about the words of Pesach, Seder. They learned Shabbos, and they even learned Chulin in high school, because Chulin was where they learned about Yeridaya, they learned about Kashrus. They learned the sections that taught them about, they didn't start with the Shechita in the beginning, they learned those parakim that dealt with the mixing with Basa B'Cholav, with Taruvos, and mixing together kosher and non-kosher things. Everything was to teach them halacha. Why? So some people said because there were girls in the school, right? I do not believe that's correct. And I'll give you my proof in a minute. It was because part of the learning, because my manager was to produce laity, it wasn't produced from Yechachamim, just educated Jews. The educated Jews had to know that every halachic thing they did was rooted in learning, in logic, and it wasn't just a pleasant custom. There was some deeper meaning to it. And the only way you could do that was teaching them the Torah Shabbat, teaching them the Gemara. Why do I say that's the reason? I came to my Maimonides, and one of my first jobs was to teach the 12th grade Gemara class. Right? The classes were all co-ed, including Gemara classes. And I went to the Rav and said, you know, I noticed that when the boys from my Maimonides come to yeshiva, they're at a certain disadvantage because they've never been exposed to the Nesechtos in Noshim and Nezikin, and therefore the concepts and terms that are found there are new to them, but they're not new to anybody else because that's what everybody else has been learning. But I just mentioned this to Rabbi Krohn, who's one of the Mashgichim uptown, who's a Bostonian, my Maimonides graduate, and he mentioned that in high school he never heard the term Migo, it's the famous term, because it didn't come up in what he learned. So I suggested that at least for the seniors, we learn something in the Zik, which included the women in the class, which I put my counterproof to the other theory. And the Rev said to me, the Babas are very hard, very difficult, and I suggested perhaps Sanhedrin, which I learned with the Rav, or Makos, and that's actually 1 year I taught Sanhedrin, and 1 year I taught Makos. Right? At some point, I left my Maimonides, and years later, many years later, when one of my sons became a high school rabbi in Maimonides, I discovered that the school had gone back to only learning those mesechtas that have to do with Allah, despite the fact that I had changed it. And I was trying to figure out what was going on. But this was something very much reflecting the Rav as a teacher, not just to the students, but the teacher of the teachers. I had come to the Rav, I was going to teach the class, I gave a good reason why I thought they should be studying something else. So even though the Rav himself had not changed his thinking, but if I was going to be the one teaching the class, and what I suggested made sense, even though the Rav didn't necessarily agree with it, he certainly let me do it. When I left, there was no one else who pushed the same argument, so we went back to what he thought was right. And I can tell you in many conversations I had with the Rav over the years, and I had the opportunity to try out some ideas that I had, if they were not contradicted by sources or illogical, the Rav would comment, you can say that. You can say that did not mean that he agreed. You can say that because it's not contradicted by sources. And it's not illogical, then it's a reasonable possibility. And if that's what you think, you can say it. Though the Rav himself thought differently. So the Rav, part of the Rav's educational philosophy was to encourage our independence. So on one hand, he was very demanding that we not be sloppy in our thinking, that we not be unprepared and say things because we didn't know the sources properly. On the other hand, we could say things different from his, from that which he thought. Famously, the Rav always wanted to rethink things. In fact, it's very unusual when we talk about Brisk. Brisk comes with a conclusion and that's it. It stays that way. The Rav rethought it. In the last few years that the Rav was saying Shir, the Rav was not well. And he struggled terribly. Right? He still asked all the right questions. It was much harder for him to get answers. So sometimes, the older people who had come back from the shir would remind the Rav of what he had said before, and the Rav's response invariably was, I don't want to hear what I said before. I don't want to repeat what I said before. That's not learning. Learning is to look at it now. And if I come to the same conclusion, great. If I come to a different conclusion, it's also fine. With the few minutes that I have left, I want to move to some other things, other ways the Rav taught people. Besides the Yortzeit Shir, the Rav gave a Tshuva Drasha. The work Al HaTshuva, which is now in both available in Hebrew and in English, is based on a number of the Tshuva Drashos, which were originally said in Yiddish, but translated to Hebrew by Pinchas Perry, and then translated to English as well. The Tshuva Drashos were geared for Rabbanim and the Rabbinical Council of America. Right? It took place between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippurim, and the Rav managed each year to find a different problem in the Rambam and to analyze a different aspect of Tshuva. If you heard the Rav, when you said the Al Klam Mukai Krakos Slach Lanu Mechal Lanu Chaper Lanu, you never thought there were three synonyms. You knew that Slach Lanu involved one concept, Mechal Lanu involved a second concept, and Chaper Lanu involved a third concept. You learned that there are different ways of people doing tshuva, different kinds of tshuva, and it was a difference from what the individual did and what the community did, right? The Rav transformed the understanding of Yom Kippurim and Rosh Hashanah, of tshuva, for the American people, because he communicated this to hundreds of rabbis every year. And the rabbis, in their own terms, in their own way, communicated on to others. I mentioned the kinos on Yom Kippur, and on Tisha B'Av. Right. Tisha B'Av, you know, is the day you're not allowed to learn Torah. It's also a day that we spend the morning saying, depending where you're davening, either some or all the kinos, which are in a difficult Hebrew. Most people don't understand too much about it. And it's to fill up the morning when we still have to sit on the floor. Right? Say the kinos. And the Rav explained the kinos. The Rav then explained who the authors of the kinos were, what the references of the kinos were. The Rav would explain the kinos. We'd go on most of the day. And people would come from all over to Boston to be there to hear the Rav explain the kinos. And ever since then, suddenly, wherever you go, people explain kinos. Right? They don't just say kinos anymore. People explain the kinos. Right? People study and say shiurim on Tisha B'Av is when they talk about Avelos. They talk about Tisha B'Av. Probably the Rav couldn't imagine a day without any learning Torah at all. So he found a way around the prohibition of learning Torah on Tisha B'Av by learning the Torah of Tisha B'Av, of the kinos. Again, something that has transformed how people say kinos ever since. And how Tisha B'Av has changed because of it. I did not mention the Rav as a philosopher, because if you sat in his Gemara Shia alone, you wouldn't have known that the Rav was a philosopher, because he didn't mix genre, right? Shia was Shia, philosophy was philosophy. Even though philosophy was rooted in halacha, it was a different, it was meant for a different purpose. Amongst the Rav's students, there were those of us who ran every time the Rav gave a philosophic talk, and those who never went to any of them. So you'll have students who say, oh, the greatness of the Rav is in Jewish philosophy, and others will say, I never heard him say a word about philosophy. He's just these traditional Talmud Chacham who only learned Torah. But to the Rav, it was all related in his mind, but he never mixed the two. At different points, at one point he decided to go lecture on college campuses and gave a series of philosophical talks that will later appear in tradition on the campuses, but those weren't necessarily done in yeshiva. One of my personal moments was at one point there was an organization called Yavne. There's still remnants of it in places like Columbia, which was an organization of religious observant students, religious students, that existed basically between 1960 and 1980. There's a book about it called The Greening of American Orthodoxy. It was founded by a group of students in Columbia, including my wife, and at one point they allowed yeshiva students to participate, and I became national president. My story. Right? But the year that I was national president was the year that the Catholic Church opened up and they wanted to, the Ecumenical Council too, and it was more open to Jews and wanted dialogue with other religions, and many Jews were very excited and participated. And the Rav felt it was a mistake. You can read the article Confrontation in Tradition, where he sets the guidelines for what you can do together with other religious groups and what you can't, according to his thinking. And he gave the talk that became Confrontation twice. Once to the rabbinate, the Medical Council of America, and once at Columbia University to the students of Yavne, inviting the philosophy and religion departments of Columbia. I had the honor of introducing him at the talk, and he was and he wanted to let them know that he was as serious a theologian as they were, because he was going against the grain, and he did a show. When he quoted a source in Greek, he said it in Greek. When he sourced in Latin, he said it in Latin. German, said it in German. He just blew everybody in the room, because when it was necessary, he would show his erudition, because that was for a very important goal of establishing the boundaries of how we retained our independence and not just sort of merging with other religions. And if it was that important, the Rav responded. I only gave you really a fraction of who the Rav was. I'll conclude with a personal anecdote or two. Like everybody else, everybody I've ever heard speak starts off saying how I first met the Rav. So I have my own anecdote. It just is indicative of how much awe we had for the Rav. It was my first year in yeshiva. The Rav was saying shiur for smicha students. The Rav used to come in from Boston on Tuesday morning, say shiur. Tuesday evening he gave the shiur to the Balabat in Maria. Then Wednesday morning he said another shiur, and then he flew back to Boston. Later years he said three shiurim a week, and I mentioned when he switched that from one time to two different shiurim. Right? So one of the fellows complained that they can never come talk to him. He's like a visiting professor. Because when he's not saying shiur, there are people outside seeing him, all kinds of important dignitaries, they couldn't get to him. So I said, you're right, after I finish the shiur and Maria, I'll come in for the base medrash and talk to him. Shiur and Maria usually finish by 10 o'clock at night. We were trying to get uptown from the west side. It was pretty late when I got there, but the boys knew they better be there. So one night, on a Tuesday night, the Rav was there, and he's talking to his Talmidim and discussing a certain sugya that they're learning in Gittin, and he asks them how to explain a certain point of view, and they tell him what the Mepharshim say on the spot. But he says, But if you prepared properly, you would know that this sugya appears more than once in Shas. And there's one place in Shas where Rashi interprets it differently. Guess what? That place was in Gemara Meruba that I was learning. And my Rebbe of Gerolach made a fuss about it. But this Rashi didn't tell everybody else. I knew the right answer. Right? And no one seemed to know. Right? And I'm waiting. And no one knows. And the Rebbe got upset. Because if they prepared properly, they would have looked through the other Gemaras where this was quoted and would have known it. And I felt I had to say something. But I was such awe of the Rav, nothing came out of my mouth. So I was learning about the Rukama. I had the Gemara in front of me. I was on the right page where the Rashi was. I walked over to the Rav, pointed to the Rashi, didn't say a word. The Rashi looked down, he said, correct, and that was it. Right? I was just too much to even try to speak to the Rav. My other little story has to do with how the Rav fostered our independence. Right? I was in my third year at Yeshiva College. I lived in Brooklyn in Borough Park, so I went home for Shabbos. So Yeshiva a week. I come home on Friday, and my father says to me, you know, you've been in Yeshiva since you're 4 years old. You don't have any exposure to the world. I want this summer for you to get a job, but not a counselor in camp, in the council. No, no, no. A real job. No idea how you get a real job. Nothing whatsoever, none whatsoever. So what are you doing? You don't know anything? You ask others. So I asked around. I was a math major in college. I found someone a year older who said, oh, I got a job for the National Bureau of Standards as a student trainee mathematician by taking a civil service. We're back in business. Taking enough tests in my life, I'll take one more test. I take the civil service test, and lo and behold, I come home on a Friday, a month later, and there's a letter waiting saying that I need to be interviewed. I'm one of the three finalists for the job. Okay? This is 1958. My father, who was an attorney, turns to me and says, you can't wear a yarmulke to the interview. We're not out for the interview, they won't give you the job. And no one were, people in the business world, no one were yarmulkes publicly in that era. This is before it was coming for him. Orthodox men to wear yarmulkes publicly. And I said, what do you mean, man? What do I wear yarmulkes? He said, look, get the job, you'll be working for the government. The government won't fire you for wearing a yarmulke. So I said, no, I have to wear a yarmulke. He said, ask the question. So I said, okay, I feel I'll ask the Rav, we'll tell me after the yarmulke. And I mean, it's fine. After Shir, I go to the Rav and I tell him the story. And the Rav responded by saying, in Germany, remember he got a doctorate in Berlin, the Orthodox people, when they work, when they're in university, never wear yarmulkes. They didn't do it. And that when his son Chaim started Harvard, because he went with Chaim privately, family privately, I told him that, and Chaim didn't listen to me, and he wore a yarmulke. And then the Rav stopped. And I bewildered, I said, Rebbe, what are you telling me? That I should do what they did in Germany, or I should do what your son Chaim did? And the Rav said, I'm not telling you anymore. You have to figure out what to do. Right? Because halachically, the saying was mutar, it's permissible not to wear the yarmulke, but on the other hand, Chaim showed that you can wear the yarmulke. So, I mean, I wore the yarmulke and got the job. So it's okay. All right? But the point was, I was, I don't know, 19 years old at the time. And the Rebbe is saying, there's decisions that you have to make. I trust you to think on your own. You're a student of mine. Part of his educational philosophy was granting us independence. Right? Because he, for two reasons. One is because he wasn't going to live forever. But there was a deeper reason. The deeper reason was because that was his notion of religious life. That religious life is not just conforming, it's a profound commitment that each one develops on himself or herself. Obviously, you have to be committed to halacha, but there's room for individuality, and you have to be prepared to make decisions, meaning that you've studied properly, and make those decisions. And you have to make the decisions as an independent adult, and not just ask every question. Very different than what's accepted in the world. You always ask your Rebbe everything, but it certainly was the model for how I try to function in all the years that I've been in yeshiva. It's one of many lessons that I learned from the Rav. And as I started pointing out, what I learned is different from what other people learned from the Rav, because he put us together and maintained our individuality. There were many people over the years, a lot of years that I was in the shir, the first time, and then a small group in the private shir in Boston, and then when I came back to Mashkech, I went to the shir of different generations. Rav had many, many talmidim, and they're all very different. They're different in many, many different ways. But they all, hopefully, absorb the commitment to Torah, the commitment to integrity and intellectual honesty that I'm off to Rav. Thank you. Oops. Hello? Yes, I'm coming right there. I'm coming down right now. Thank you. Actually, it's not been right now. I'm coming down in 10 minutes. But she called me. So I'm open to any questions that you may have. As long as I get down there, because I'm supposed to introduce very well, and it's like 9:30. I'm being an optimist. But with a little luck and not so much traffic, I'll get there. Any questions, anything else? Yes.
How do you think you sort of like got more comfortable with the Rav as you knew him? Like in the first anecdote, you were so in awe that you couldn't even say anything, and then you were very comfortable asking questions.
Good question. I think, you know, when you get to know someone, you spend more time with the person. You know, you get more comfortable, you know, doing things. Remember, the first time when I was so in awe of the Rav, I was not in the shir. I just heard of the Rav. I was this 17-year-old kid, you know, in my first year in YU, you know, sitting in a corner in the Beis Medrash when the Rav is talking to his 22-year-old, right? A couple of years later, I'm sitting in the shir, so I'm part of the process. So. Yeah. Yes.
So it was really interesting how you mentioned that he didn't mix like Mada and Torah, even though he thought that they were connected. I've heard people present it that he like looked at the world through a Torah lens, so they weren't two distinct entities. Do you think that's different, or?
It's a bit. Look, he definitely looked at everything through a Torah lens, and yet he was very intellectually open. And all the questions of whether what should be taught and not taught in yeshiva and Stern, whenever there's a more liberal view that some yeshivas don't agree with, it's because the Rav was more open, right? Because he felt that it could be incorporated within Torah. In other words, he didn't see, you know, science as counter-religion. Different domains. And therefore they were both be true, right? He expected us to get a serious secular education. Now, different periods of time were different, right? So when I first came to yeshiva, it was a much more rational time. It was a time, I came to YU in 1955. It was 10 years after the victory at the end of the Second World War. The full impact of the Holocaust we didn't understand. We now had a state of Israel, right? Jews in America, there's less anti-Semitism, we're becoming successful, everything with history. But it's a world where nuclear power, Sputnik, right? Science, the future. And that was a great challenge to Judaism that was old and customs. But if you learn from Shi with the Rav, you never had any problem. There are two people, you know, different people in this book. One who came out from, you know, professor of philosophy in Brandeis, who said that when he went to grad school and had the top philosophers in the country, he was never overwhelmed, but none of them were as smart as the Rav. And another one who remained from but became a great chemist said the exact same thing. So for us, that was extremely important, right? That Torah was intellectually on the highest of levels. Today's world is more interested in spirituality. So the issues are different, right? It was the right person at the right time. The Rav was the Rav anyway. He wouldn't have been any different. His commitment to the Torah was absolute, and yet his intellectual curiosity was all over the place. Right? When his wife was sick, he learned more about treating cancer than every doctor. He read up everything possible. So, he was just very open intellectually to all kinds of things. But you wouldn't know it in the Shir. It didn't come up in the Shir. Every once in a few words, there'd be a comment that somebody would get, you know. But wasn't there. Torah is Torah. He wanted people to have a serious secular education. Absolutely. He didn't favor it. Favor of humanities. You know, he wasn't even interested in business school. That's not secular education. That's not real stuff, you know. But there was a broadness accompanied with an incredible commitment, right? His commitment to Torah was such that he assumed we were equally committed, right? So I remember one specific situation where the Rav asked a question that no one thought of, which happened often, and he was spending time worrying about it. And the boys and she were basically lost. So just sitting there talking to each other because we had no idea what's going on, right? The Rav turns to us and said, if I didn't ask the question, it wouldn't bother you. So why am I working so hard to come to answer if you don't care enough? And that to us was tremendous news. I mean, we didn't care enough to find out what the answer was. Right? We weren't committed enough to the truth of Torah that once we told the question and we just said, okay, let the Rav answer it. No? We should care enough, right? His commitment to the truth of Torah, to understanding it on the deepest of levels, was absolute. It was just unbelievable. You know, he was the amount of time, there was shiurim that went on forever until he figured something out. And then he'd come back the next week and either change it or re-explain it to make it better, because you want to know the truth. And if you have, and the truth, his commitment is, he knew Torah was true, so his commitment was done. Okay, I think I'm going to go downstairs so I can make it.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Hi.
I'll take care of it.
Hi.
Thank you. I'm Talia.
Talia
Hyman.